My name is Elby Klein, and I work as a consultant primarily for Prevention Innovations Research Center, which facilitates the Bringing in the Bystander program, which was mentioned earlier. But the main reason and capacity I'm here in, as Deb mentioned earlier, is as someone who worked for many years directing the prevention and advocacy efforts around gender-based violence on campus. And I currently co-facilitate an organization called Campus Advocates and Prevention Professionals Association, which brings together folks who are doing this work on campuses around the country. I'll talk a little bit about what people are doing on the ground, on individual campuses throughout the country. So with increased legislation, student activism, federal attention, national attention, this is such an incredible crucible moment and cultural moment for us around violence. It's the moment that truthfully for many of us in this room who dedicated our careers to this issue have been waiting for, right? Awareness raised, check, yes, right. Super exciting, but actually implementing these regulations, actually doing this work on our multifaceted campuses that all look very different around the country has its challenges and opportunities. So I'm going to talk through a little bit about what those comprehensive approaches look like, addressing this issue on multiple levels, some challenges and opportunities, and then what some campuses are doing about it. First, on a comprehensive approach note, there are many different and amazing toolkits out there. I've referenced a few at the bottom of this slide that outline what comprehensive approaches to violence look like. That we've really, this morning, Deb talked about, Dr. Ourey talked about various different aspects that the White House Task Force to Protect Students has talked about. As we drill down into each of those areas, there are myriad things that we need to be doing to truly comprehensively address violence. Here are seven of them. With a comprehensive approach, we need to develop inclusive task forces. We need to bring multiple people together to the table from various perspectives. So folks for whom this is their issue as content experts, folks who positionally are in places on campus to make change, those who are working in responding to violence, those who are working in preventing it, and of course the folks who are in a community, ensuring that we have students and their voices represented. And I appreciated what Jesse mentioned earlier, not only those students who are working closely on this issue, although we should have survivors in all of our spaces and folks who care about this issue in all of our spaces as we address it, but also students from various parts of campus. We need to conduct environmental scans and needs assessments. I'm at a public health conference, so I know for us, that's something that we, of course, say step one, but that's often challenging, right? We have this environment right now where we need to have done all of this yesterday, and I love the excitement of that and the pressure that it puts on. I appreciate it. It's so helpful. But sometimes that keeps us from, in our communities, taking a step back and saying, what do we already have? What do we really need? What does this look like here? If I'm interested in cultivating a bystander approach on my campus, what does that look like in my specific community? Who's at the table? How do we actually implement training in our environment? And looking at what are we doing well, what are we doing not so well, and what might make sense here? And in what order do we do it? That, for example, if we're implementing new prevention programming, right? If we're talking prevention for maybe the first time in our campus community, we know that if we're talking about an issue, until we've done the work of really reducing those prevalence rates, folks are going to need help and support, right? That we're going to, if we do workshops all over campus to engage folks as bystanders, for example, that we're going to have more students at the end of that disclose that they've experienced violence, who are going to need advocacy, who are going to need services and support. And we need to think about our capacity as we go through this. We need to craft strong policy as well as protocol. Not only sending the message that our campuses are intolerant of violence, ensuring our policy is compliant, but ensuring that we have protocol that is transparent. And Deb mentioned this quite a bit earlier when it comes to the confidentiality piece, ensuring that students have those confidential resources to go to and that everyone on campus knows exactly what their specific role is and can provide help according to that role. We need to provide coordinated community response that is trauma-informed. For those of us who've worked in violence prevention and response, coordinated community response, has been a significant part of our work for a long time. But it can be challenging sometimes to bring together various folks on campus when sometimes we need to figure out, are we collaborating, are we coordinating, or are we cooperating? What is the nature of our relationships? And we need to ensure that that's trauma-informed. And trauma-informed approaches, right, really involve being intentional and involve slowing down and saying, what is going to make folks comfortable coming into a space? What is going to mitigate trauma? What is going to ensure that someone's really going to want to go through these processes and feel affirmed and supported? That's sometimes challenging to do when we're enacting legislation that's new, when we're saying, okay, we're going to send out an email to our entire campus community that all employees on campus are responsible for reporting violence, right? That's a big thing to say. And it's challenging to be trauma-informed in reaction to mandates. So it's important for us to really put that at the forefront of all of our approaches, not just we need to roll this out, we need to be in compliance, but what does this mean for the people in our community who have survived violence? What does it mean for their friends? What does it mean for the faculty member they're disclosing to? What does that look like? That goes into, in many ways, training people according to their roles, that they're it's critical from a primary prevention perspective to ensure that everybody on campus knows their role in preventing violence. But we have folks who have special roles and different roles in the lives of people on our university campuses. That the training that might be necessary for an incoming first-year student is not the same as for a resident advisor on campus who's responsible for facilitating a community. It's perhaps not the same as somebody who is the director of the nursing program. Is not the same as somebody who might be in a staff position that would likely involve them seeing a lot of what's happening on campus, such as someone who directs Greek life. We also want to develop and implement campus plans for prevention. That a lot of times what can happen with our strategies that we're implementing is we have a lot of words, and they're in many ways well-defined and defined in ways that are exciting for us as preventionists. I don't have it on these slides, but the definition of risk reduction, according to the VAWA regulations, is what we would have hoped for a long time. We're looking at not blaming folks for experiencing violence, but saying that we all as a community have responsibility. That's incredible. But we want to have a plan for prevention that, as I talked about in the previous point, really addresses what are the levels that we're looking at, what should a student know by the time they're graduating? What does that mean for somebody who's an undergraduate student versus a medical student? What does it mean if you're staff or faculty here? What does that curriculum look like? And as institutions of higher education, we are good at that. We're good at crafting educational plan. We need to consider this a part of the institutional mission, and therefore we need a plan consistent with that. And we need to establish pathways for ongoing feedback and evaluation. We can't just create something and not be seeking constant feedback and evaluating what we're doing. Is that sometimes in the current compliance-oriented culture, our idea of being effective can be, I complied with this regulation. I'm doing something about bystander. I have a policy. We're checking off these boxes, and that's important right now. That's a real concern for campuses, complying with federal law. But we need to think, how are we evaluating this? What do we mean when we say we have a successful prevention program? What do we mean by that? And what's great as public health professionals is that is what you do. We can provide guidance to folks on how we actually see that what we're doing is successful. And I concur with Jesse that what I appreciate about a bystander approach is that we're talking about hope in many ways. And it can be really challenging if we're looking so far ahead of our goal and our vision, and it should be, is to end violence in all forms. That we don't want to have intimate partner violence, sexual violence, stalking on our campus or in our communities. But that can feel very far off. We need to ensure that folks can see that incremental change as it's happening. They can see the knowledge and attitudes of folks shift if we're not seeing the prevalence. They can see, as Deb mentioned earlier, if more people are coming forward, that's a good thing. We need to define those metrics for our colleagues. I'm going to go into this in too much detail, but my current research is a lot on what folks who are on the ground, folks who are directing campus prevention advocacy efforts, are experiencing in the current milieu. We don't have a lot of data. We're creating some of the first on even the number of campus-based prevention advocacy programs. We'll be releasing a lot of this in 2016, but this is some preliminary stuff. What are our challenges as a field? And many of us I know in the room are practitioners, perhaps on campuses. And these are some of our challenges and opportunities that our colleagues mentioned in our interviews with them. Experts are often seen as biased. Again, I'm preaching to the public health crowd. It happens, right? Like, well, of course you care about the issue of sexual violence. You've been, you know, doing this since you were 19 years old in a student hotline. Of course you care about it. And of course, when we're dealing with this issue, we need to be fair right now, right? There's a big idea around the idea of fairness. So sometimes expertise can be seen as biased. There's a culture of compliance that I talked about earlier that can be challenging. We'll talk about that again in a second. There's a real lack of resources available. A lot of these mandates are unfunded. And so we need the infrastructural support to do work, to educate all of the students who are on a campus in a meaningful way, can seem really daunting. And it can be easy for campus administrators to, and fiscally feasible, to go to implementing online modules and saying, okay, we did it. Okay, we sent an email out to the entire community talking about how bystander intervention is really important. And now prevention achieved. We have a lack of people power, a lack of financial power to do this work. I know many people who have the privilege in many ways, because these programs are not everywhere, to serve in part-time or full-time roles as violence preventionists who have zero budget. They have no money. And so that's really difficult if they have 14, 20, 30,000 students, and in some cases also faculty and staff. The work is seen at odds with institutional mission, that this is add-on stuff, not stuff that's integral to the success of our students. And staff turnover and burnout, I appreciate your attention earlier to self-care and laughter and remembering that we are also humans outside of our work. There is an incredibly high turnover rate in our fields. And in many ways, because of the increased mandates, there are folks who are in positions sometimes on campuses that they didn't really ask for. We have folks who are serving in Title IX coordinator roles who did not intend to go into a prevention field, into working with sexual violence as an issue, and that can be really difficult. And also isolation, that within campus communities, folks can sometimes be the only person who is addressing this issue. And instead of serving in a role of coordinator, and coordinating for all of us means this is a part of everybody's job description, but I coordinate what those efforts look like, they can be put in a position of you go ahead and handle it. You go ahead and prevent the violence, and that can be difficult. Opportunities, though, is exciting with this federal legislation. With this increased student activism and organization of students across the country who are holding campuses accountable and are speaking truth to power in amazing ways. And we have an emphasis on community prevention more so than we did before. That we have recommendations from the federal government that says that this is a community issue. That's amazing. That we have that and not a focus on individual risk reduction. And this is newly prioritized, that in any space that I am, at a student affairs conference, if I'm at a legal conference, if I'm anywhere that relates to campuses, this is on the agenda now. And it's critical for us to leverage those moments. In our interviews, a colleague summed it up pretty well in the current environment. Sexual violence is being treated like a new epidemic, taking campuses by storm, rather than the endemic societal issue it is. On campuses in particular, there's an increased challenge in separating prevention programming from policy programming. They are being conflated in our educational programs, but the pedagogy should not be the same for both. Because the policy says so does not change attitudes or cultures. That it's challenging sometimes in an environment that is about policy and rights, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be, those are critical components to any of our work, right, if we're looking at our social ecology. If it's about policy and consequence, that is never going to help us sometimes with public health approaches. It's challenging in many ways. We've seen this with alcohol on campus, right? If we're addressing underage drinking on campus, because the law says you're under 21, don't drink, not our strategy, right? So it's critical for us to figure out ways to talk about policy, to be clear and critically clear that we are against violence and that we need policies for adjudication, but we want to work upstream, right? We want to ensure with primary prevention that we're talking to people about their lives and not just this is a federal rights issue. As a survivor advocate for more than a decade with students, saying to a student that I'm working with who survived violence, this is a justice issue and this is a violation of your rights, is not a message that is usually very well received for somebody who perhaps experienced violence by someone who they care about, their classmate, a friend of theirs. We're talking about prevention in these terms as well. We need to think beyond solely policy. Some key questions for campus folks, thank you, as we are working on this issue. One of them is, what is our current level of readiness and assessing that readiness? A lot of times, because we have this guidance toward all campuses, campuses who are in a place where they have robust programs are trying to do the same thing as campuses who maybe they don't actually have mental health services at all on their campus, or they don't have a community rape crisis center that they're contracted with. Who are our partners that we're doing this together, that we need to work together, not only within our campus communities, but in our broader community? What is our vision? Keeping track of that vision and not getting bogged down in regulations, and we need to comply with these specific regulatory guidance. What are our prevention strategies? What is our actual approach? Not just our programming, not just we do this for first year students and then we have a workshop that's available and then we're doing these things in a box. What is our actual overall strategy when it comes to prevention? Is sexual assault prevention linked to the university mission statement? That if we are saying that this is something we need to eradicate on our campus, it's as pervasive as my colleagues have mentioned it is statistically, and this is impeding the success of our students, that Title IX is saying that discrimination of this nature and gender-based violence is impeding our students' ability to graduate, to be successful on campus, then inherently ending sexual violence is a part of our mission statement. And it's linked directly and clearly to that for all of our stakeholders. Is that always super important to students on the ground who are attending a workshop? Not as much. But is it critical for the work that we're doing to get the infrastructure for this? Absolutely. A few more. Is our work trauma-informed and survivor-centered? Are we ensuring that folks who have survived violence are a key part of this? I know that many of my colleagues, as we were doing these interviews, pointed out many times that they were in meetings about sexual violence prevention where we never actually talked about survivors, students, the people who are going through this, perpetrators. We're talking about regulation and guidance alone. We need to also have that human piece at the forefront. Is our information actually accessible? Are we centering marginalized or underrepresented groups? Do we know their needs? Or are we only seeing the students who are able to be vocal in our spaces? How are students involved in shaping those plans? And are we ready for what happens as we are more and more successful? Are we ready for that attention? Are we ready to defend the fact that, yes, our reporting numbers have gone up, and that's a good thing? Are we ready to say, yes, we are dedicating resources to violence prevention? Yes, all students will be going through this training, not just because we want to comply with federal law, but because it's important to us. I'm going to highlight a few of my colleagues' programs briefly, and then I will wrap up. Four different schools. We are very familiar with the social ecological model, and our colleagues at Harvard University in their OSAPR office spent a lot of their time working with students and key stakeholders on campus to define what are our strategies at each of these levels and showing that directly to students. This thumbprint that you see here contains a lot of words around violence. They realized many students didn't know what some of those words meant, so they went through a lot to define those terms, to have those accessible on their website, accessible around campus, so students knew what they meant, and they could see the priorities of Harvard and of this office. They've also very intentionally created specific positions for prevention that focus on not only undergraduate students, but graduate and professional students, and saying graduate and professional students have different needs. We need to ensure that we're addressing them. Emory University's Respect Program, where I will acknowledge I did used to work a couple years ago, has been implementing bystander intervention approaches that range and start in orientation and through multiple media, including creating a customized comic book that destigmatized the issue a little bit of intimate partner violence, provided a medium to ensure that folks could read about it, and ensure that folks were not only receiving information like a handout of bystander intervention tips, but something they could really sink their teeth into, while also having follow-up in-person training, and centered this issue as a broader part of ending oppression on campus more broadly. University of Wisconsin-Madison's End Violence on Campus program developed their own orientation programs that then feed through all 4 years of an undergraduate student's experience so that they're aware not only at the start of their education but throughout that their campus is intolerant of violence and what they can do in their role. they also, we talk a lot about engaging men, particularly engaging men in fraternities. They created a 4-credit course that engages fraternity men as agents of change in ending violence. And lastly, University of Michigan, Michigan's logic models around violence are to be envied. If you contact Holly Ryder Milkovich, she will share them with you. They are things of beauty if you're a public health person. But they work in the residence halls for a program called Relationship Remix to ensure that we're talking about intimate partner violence and dating violence with our first-year students where they live. And they've also had a great deal of success in creating documents such as Striving for Justice that really talk folks through their options on campus in the community, and also work to say to rethink how we see accountability. That's some more information about that. And so there's a lot of work for us to be done, but what's exciting is that folks are doing it and doing it in really creative and innovative ways that are particularly situated in their own campus communities. Thank you.
Thank you for that. I don't know if you all are like me, but being in public health subjects you to recognizing how much is going on in the world. It can be kind of depressing. But I think sessions like this are so exciting because it showcases all the great work that's being done. So a round of applause again for our entire panel. And with that, I'll open it up for questions. Yes, yellow. Sure. And can you stand, please, so we can hear you? If you don't mind, thank you. Okay, well, remain seated. Thank you. So do you want to hear what's going on beyond bystander intervention, maybe, or do you want to respond to that, Deb? Or?
So I can start with talking about some technical practices that I briefly highlighted at the end, and bystanders is just one part of it. We have things exactly like what you're talking about on things promoting social norms that prevent violence, looking at leadership opportunities and training for girls and women, promoting safe environments, and in there we actually did mention risk reduction as one of the different examples, but also, again, looking at things like Hollaback, where you can use social media to talk about where there might be increasing street harassment. So we try to look at different policies, different programs around that. And then really around just teaching skills to prevent violence, things like Dating Matters that we've used from earlier adolescents to talk about, respectful relationships, things like that. And then finally, just again, really supporting survivors to things like cognitive-based therapy. To prevent that secondary aspect of violence. So for our technical practice, we'll have all the different aspects. And so I agree, there's no one size fits all. I think it depends on the environment, it depends on the community's needs, resources. And for things that happen in private, bystander may not work, although if you've been exposed to it, you can understand what to look for, and there's some changing social norms around that. But that's where our teaching skills to prevent violence in a safe environment as part of our technical pathway.
Jesse, you are happy.
Yeah, if I can say a little, I don't think bystander intervention is a panacea, but I do think there is a reason for something, and there certainly is evidence that it's effective, so I can speak to Greenhead in particular. The University of Kentucky was funding from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Anko Berger, the lead researcher, did a 5-year study on Green Dot, where in 5 years they saw more than 50% reduction in the sexual violence in schools that got Green Dot, which was a bystander intervention strategy. fiscal that didn't get a slight increase, so there certainly is evidence for not the only
program that is.
I keep asking. Yeah, this peer seems to take forever. But the other thing I want to say is shifting social emotions is a very important part of prevention, and it is long-term work. We are decades into shifting gender norms. We have decades more in front of us. In the meantime, people are being assaulted every single day. So it's a strategy that, can I get bystanders intervening at parties tonight to stop assault from happening while we're doing the long-term work of shifting social norms? And I think the other thing that we sort of as a field have considered is gender norms are not the only ones that need to change. In fact, norms around bystander behavior also need to be changed, and that sort of sense of collective responsibility we as community members are responsible, not just the potential victims and potential perpetrators. And so it calls into question some of those other kinds of social norms beyond gender and relationships.
I would add that we're doing a lot of these things at once, but there is also overload that is challenging, especially when we're trying to advocate for time. And I say this, we're standing in front of many folks that are bringing the bystander program. Our long program is 4.5 hours. And campus administrators share me, like, I have told them that they need to, have people in a room for a week. That the time is challenging, and from a primary prevention standpoint, we also want to make sure we can start with this messaging in ways that mitigate backlash. And I know that for bringing in the bystander program, that's been extensively discussed as something that is really important with ensuring folks can get an entry point into messaging. Said that a lot of the folks that I work with, the direct prevention advocacy programs on campus, are working on multiple levels in their communities, are having really intentional conversations about gender, about sexuality. That at Emory University, for example, their orientation programming, sexual violence prevention is situated within their educational programming and orientation about privilege, power, and difference. That's where it is. And I would argue as well that bystander intervention and thinking about our community is inherently a part of our work in social justice. And so I think that what's really critical is that I think we should be held accountable for not only adopting one strategy, but I think it is a very promising strategy, both from what the evidence is showing us for effectiveness, but also implementation, which right now on a wide scale in this cultural moment is very important for us to be considering what we can get folks to be in spaces and ensure that they can identify.
Great, thank you. Yes, question.
Hi, Dr. Chairman, so from the UCF, I want to know about the campus sexual assault act that is now quite all publicly funded in colleges and led by parent intervention training, among other requirements on the science also for newly funded project from CDC, where we thought the ANCOR action, we will be testing the relative efficacy of the different bystander intervention programs being implemented across 24 colleges across the country, because the federal requirement doesn't require you to do, for example, an in-person intervention. You can pick among them, and so we'll be seeing which components are most effective at reducing sexual violence and other outcomes that are interested. Also, which ones are most cost-effective. And we're hoping that information from this study will actually feed back into the federal policy, perhaps requiring campuses to be more, to engage in more intensive training, as opposed to, for example, online training,
if you find
that
that is
done
that way.
Great, thank you. Questions?
Yes. So, we talked about incorporating assignments and making it across different disciplines. Have you ever been working in identifying professors incorporating these messages or assignments or activities in their classes?
Or papers, someone talked about writing papers. Is that what you, are you referencing
so
that?
Are you aware of any practices of where professors have incentives to incorporate? Is there some, if you're a biology professor or a social work professor, to incorporate an assignment or to incorporate an activity that may be along the disciplines but also inclusive of sexual assault?
So there are lots of universities where faculty have found ways to integrate into curriculum. I'm not aware of anyone that's created an incentive program, but certain universities where it's been integrated and they've offered courses for credit.
And only with 4
there's a lot of institutions and professors that are allying with content experts. I think the challenge is who is teaching that material, right? So if you're a biology professor, you know, I think about it, I had a previous supervisor who was an amazing sports medicine doctor, and he's like, I need someone else to come in and teach about this. I'm a sports medicine doctor, right? I teach about this. Or I'm in a particular area. So I think that what's critical are those partnerships, and I've seen a lot of really amazing and creative approaches. So an example from a colleague of mine, they had a journalism, their entire journalism department, because of the attention to sexual violence that was happening in the media, they made these open forums where folks who were experts would provide information about sexual violence, they talk about some recent events that have been in the news, and that was their assignment for every single journalism student that year, was to write about this issue. And not only write about it, because we're talking about the issue, but here's some nuances about how you write about it. Here's guidance. Here's what Columbia School of Journalism is putting out about that, which has been incredibly helpful to educate students within their disciplines, which is also important. We want, on a primary prevention level, for folks to intervene and to work with each other to end violence on that level. We also are training future leaders, and we want those leaders, regardless of what they're doing, to be aware of this issue. Because as we know in this room, this issue touches so many different disciplines. And so I think it'd be excellent to see more incentives for that, but I wonder how that would work with the faculty government.
Do you have a question?
I actually just had a comment about a previous question related to bystander intervention, being the magical and also how to address social norms and general issues. And actually, bystander intervention is a very good way to address general issues. I know a lot of times when we think about bystander intervention, we're thinking about the higher risk situation and preventing a sexual assault in the moment, stopping it from happening. But there are other ways to intervene that are lower risk that include when someone uses gender terminology. Or a very, I guess, kind of funny example of, we have a little mini health break at where I used to work, and we take turns leading them, and one of my friends leads them one day, and she said, you can't do a full push-up, do a girly push-up. And I was like, no, you don't call them girly push-ups, they are modified. So those are little ways that you can still intervene in some way to try to start shifting some of those norms. And she blew it off a little bit. She came back to it and was like, you know what? I've never even thought about the fact that I use that terminology. And that this is a content area that don't work for you. This just don't work for you. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Yes.
We're seeing that a lot of party things as well, looking at training with students, particularly around bystander intervention, if they're intervening and they're not having, you know, I hate to use these words, but I will, you know, corporate pros and tenants of those parties, and that they're saying this is part of a culture of violence, and this is perpetuating violence, and self-regulating and self-enforcing in those ways that are really vital to changing our culture around gender.
I had a question in place.
Yeah, I think I appreciated hearing about trauma-informed care. That would be one of the things I'm concerned about, though, is like emphasizing certain types of assignments in classes, because some of your students in your class have been a victim or have had something. And I've had some students come to me this year. We do alerts on our campus where it comes in a text, it comes in an email. So every time within the perimeter of the campus or on the campus, whether it's a sexual assault or a robbery, physical assault of some kind, we know it was a male to female, male to male, female to female. We know, did the victim go to the hospital? I have students come and approach me saying, this is too much. It feels like I've been assaulted again. Mm-hmm. So I break that issue, but it's not going anywhere yet because I have students come to me this year. I think within our first week of opening, we have three assaults again. So every time, every fact, and it's so for faculty and staff and students, there's a perception of unsafe because now the manager is reporting. So there has to be something yet with that we haven't figured out in my school that's not the proper mix. But now people are feeling unsafe walking in.
And what I would say to that is, I know we had worked on that a little bit in a prior path, but I think when those alerts come out, not to say don't walk in dark places, that's what they usually say, but to talk about, you know, violence prevention in general, say this and more that schools can talk about whether it's a bystander approach or not tolerating any sort of violence or oppression versus
keep your keys in your hands as you're walking to the parking lot.
But that's not the message. The message almost reads like a police report. So that's why I raised the issue. I mean, I...
It doesn't have the resources or next steps at the bottom?
You have to go through the whole long thing, and okay. I have a few students who have been victims approaching me to say, just to get through that,
right.
to get to the resources, I have to shut it down. And so that, how do we do that in a better way is the question.
I think you bring up a really important challenge that we're having right now of ensuring that we're, as we move our marker from reporting and prevalence, right, is that we're heading to a point where our prevalence, we're hoping and starting to catch, we're going to go down, but our reporting is going to keep going up as we get there. And if we truly were receiving alerts on our campus every time there was a special assault, I mean, that would just be incredibly overwhelming to look at our statistics, right? So even if we're receiving three of those alerts, we know that's not the problem. But that's also very scary. People who are not educated on the issues, and it's also very re-traumatizing for survivors. And actually, CAPA, the organization I'm part of, is creating some model language around those campus alerts that campuses do need to comply with laws that they need to provide timely warning. But what can we put at the top of that message to say, this is the message that's going to be about this, so that folks are aware in advance that they don't have to start scrolling through this and thinking that it might be something that they need to, they maybe don't want to make a choice to not be paying attention to that. And that's our difficulty, right? We're doing crime intervention. We want everybody on a campus to have certain knowledge and skills. We also need to be mindful of the fact that there are people who are on our campus who are walking around every day trying to absolutely avoid anything about that. And that's a constant tension we have in our work and one we need to be truly mindful of.
Thank you. Yes, you're right.
So my question,
can you stand up, maybe?
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
So I currently am a MCH student, but I'm also advisor for a sorority at my old school. And I've noticed that sororities and fraternities kind of have this unique environment where alcohol is really perpetuated. Well, the don't talk about the sexual assault is kind of one of those things where, like you said, you're at a party and the girls walk upstairs and no one says anything. They kind of just act like they don't see it. So I don't know. Do you think there's a unique way you would have to address, like, the bystander intervention with them? Is it something you kind of have to address in a different way? Because I know it really is that don't talk about it, don't see it mentality. I mean, even with the parties, they have these themes where they don't want to say that thing's inappropriate. They don't want to kind of stand out because then you're known as the, you know, the girl or the guy that stood out and no one wants to now hang out with you. It's kind of like, because it's that young mentality, but there's almost like a fear of being. So I'm not sure how do I address with, you know, the women that I work with every day when we're working about social media and PR and being strong, confident women. How do you kind of encourage them, empower them, that being a bystander, being observant is also being empowering and kind of helps to alleviate this current culture?
I think part of the problem is that the fraternities and sororities have been as the problem for so very long, and that there is that has been changing this issue. It is precisely because these are the places where crimes are happening that fraternities and sororities aren't included. That those are the very best bystanders on our campuses, that parties don't mean that sexual assault is happening in fact, parties can be safe. And so I think it is because we are the ones who are organizing the parties, we are the most important, one of the most important parts of the solution on this campus, that we are making safe spaces, that we are intervening in. And I think that certainly fraternities and sororities have histories of community engagement, caring about social issues, and so having that value system that's already in place.
And I don't know if you saw the Lady Gaga video that came out like a month or so ago. I thought, I mean, I've shown clips from like the hunting ground or the trailer and talks I've given, but the Lady Gaga video was even more pushing that. So I have not shown clips of that, but I think, you know, for some of these groups, you know, having that out there a little bit more, I think, puts a face to it and to the point to go behind, it can be traumatizing. But I think it shows why we need to talk about it. When I was a college student many, many, many years ago, like greater than 20, I remember a lot of kind of the unseen, like the fraternity guys that, like, my guy friends would say, you don't want to hang out with him, and pull me away all the time. But we had sexual assault in one of my sorority sisters, and that really changed, I think, at least our sorority, because then we did talk about a lot more, how can we not allow this to happen to anybody else. So I think, just at this point, you know, it's just, you know, how colleges are going to be social, there's going to be alcohol, and so how do you mitigate these circumstances and have everybody aware, because we're not going to change all of that. So I think this allows for having more of those discussions tomorrow night.
Also how we're having those conversations, but I think that a lot of our strategies in working with sororities and fraternities from a public health perspective focus a lot on new members because they're accessible. New members have to go through certain kinds of education, and so look for the room and talk about alcohol and easy and sexual violence, and particularly talk about stuff that we don't want them to do. And I think that what I've seen and what the research bears out in many ways is that if we're looking at folks who are role models and who are mentoring younger students and who will look up to, that we know that if those folks have some capacity and understanding around these issues, they're the ones who are more shaping the space. They're deciding the party games, they're deciding who's going to these parties, they're, you know, setting some of those norms. And so to me, it's also engaging not only with, we have 150 people at a chapter meeting, and let's have the topic be sexual violence, we'll bring in a speaker for 20 minutes to talk about consent, then they have more time to make fun of me than the actual thing. But it can be helpful to say, you know, this as a more role, which is a critical one, right, with advising students, you know, having the leaders, a very small group of leaders, and saying, hey, you know, this is a really important issue, providing some basic education, and saying, you know, what are your thoughts on this? What do you think that we can do? How does this relate to our values as a sorority or a fraternity? And as both of you mentioned, I know a few group organizations that don't have some value to get around brothers and sisters watching out for us. Yeah. I think it's actually a really helpful, you know, tool for my family to have that information.
Here and then just waiting. Yes.
Actually, a comment first. In my undergraduate career, we would have alerts, and they come out days after assaults, robberies, and it's like, what are we supposed to do as students to be proactive against this? What's happening days, we know days after, weeks after. And then we're currently MSPH students in North Carolina, and we're working to implement shifting boundaries in a seventh grade classroom. And my question is, you know, when does primary prevention start to have these long-term effects? Because sometimes we get blank stares from the seventh graders, and sometimes there's, you know, the ones that are engaged, and they're like, wow, you know, that is how far my personal space is. When do we begin that?
You know, I think it goes to what Jessica was talking about earlier about how it's framed, too. You know, like, we're saying, you know, don't be a perpetrator, don't be a victim. So with shifting boundaries, I think, you know, that's a really good curriculum. 6th to 8th grade adolescence period is a good time to start having at least a lot of these conversations. It's one of the things you never know where people are, you know, on the spectrum, pre-contemplation, contemplation, action. And so I just think at least engaging at that stage opens people's minds to how it's not the first time they've heard of it. Particularly, you want to do a lot before people start dating. And I can tell you that there's people that have had a lot of relationships, but if they've been that same in the pregnancy. So, you know, I think that's not too early to start those conversations.
Thank you. You had a question? Do you still have a question? Yes, you.
My other comment is that it's kind of along with the saying that the work is really hard.
the myths that you're talking about, but you know, I think there's just some good systematic reviews out there that do talk to that. I think just having a short, you know, paper for them that highlights that, because as a faculty member that used to sit on those review panels, at least I understood it, but a lot of the people around me didn't. And so our technical package is, I think, like 40 or 50 pages. It does have, like, the executive summary in the front, so if people don't read anything else, they'll read that. But my concern is it's going to go too in-depth to get to those.
Have you seen the Striving for Justice toolkit out of the University of Michigan?
No.
I would look at that. And it is specifically developed for Michigan, so there's adaptation necessity there for sure. But it was developed in collaboration with their community organizations as well, and is an incredible from their Sexual Assault Prevention and Awareness Center. And it provides a lot of the guidance that you're mentioning and talks through what those processes should look like. And it's really from the perspective of someone who's serving in a role in those processes. And very much brings it down to a level of, you are new to this, and your role is X. And there are a lot of parts you can kind of drag and drop out of there.
Did you have a question?
So one of the critiques that I guess I've heard about my program is that maybe the next step that it would need to go to is holding communities accountable for intervening. So, for example, holding student groups accountable for hosting safe events, hosting safe parties. If there is an assault, reacting appropriately towards perpetrators or survivors who are members of the group. What are your thoughts on that? And have you seen these tools that are implementing policies or programs related to holding specific communities responsible for intervening in these
events? So I can say I'm not aware of anyone that has where any sanctions. Well, certainly in military settings, that's the military tools. There are sanctions for bystanders who don't, because they have an honor code that goes beyond simply not perpetrating assault. So I'm not aware. I think there could be a place for accountability. I think, I'm not sure how I feel about it, if we should recommend it or not.
I mean, I think that I hope I speak for both of us. I know I speak for both. When the bystander message is, of course, saying the person responsible for the violence is the person perpetrating the violence. I think that can also be a challenging conversation that we're not. If we're just talking about bystander intervention without going into the whole training of what we're saying, everybody's responsibility, we're not saying everybody's responsibility for perpetrated violence. That is the perpetrator's responsibility. I think that what might be helpful to look at, though, are some of the standards that are coming forward through organizations like the Association of Student Conduct Administrators, who are providing some guidance around what does it mean for organizational accountability, and that's something that's been going on for some time. And I think on issues like sexual violence and looking at culture and investigating culture and how people are perpetuating violence in certain residence hall areas, in certain houses or fraternal organizations, looking at off-campus housing and how it's related with university and what accountability looks like. Those are conversations that have been happening for some time, but have gained a lot more traction around particularly sexual violence. It's not solely there is a member in your community who did this and you're removed.
I think we're wrapping up, but I believe the panelists will stay after folks have a few questions before going to the next session. So thanks again to our panelists. Thanks to you all for attending.